This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Alan Horowitz about his new book, DSM, A History of Psychiatry's Bible. Over the past 70 years, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, has evolved from a virtually unknown and little-used pamphlet to an imposing and comprehensive compendium of mental disorders. Its nearly 300 conditions have become the touchstones for the diagnosis that patients receive, students are taught, researchers study, insurers reimburse, and drug companies promote. In DSM, Alan Horowitz examines how the manual, known colloquially as Psychiatry's Bible, has been at the center of thinking about mental health in the United States since its original publication in 1952. This comprehensive treatment should appeal to not only specialists, but also anyone who is interested in how diagnoses of mental illness have evolved over the past seven decades, from unwanted and often imposed labels to resources that led to valued mental health treatments and social services.
I can't see or hear you.
Well, Alan, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks. It's very good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here with us today. So as we have witnessed the unprecedented times of the global pandemic recently, I was wondering if we could start with you reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and perhaps the main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
Well, I think I've had a very unusual experience because, you know, I haven't been going out as much. I certainly haven't been traveling as much. So I've really had more time to spend on my work. So I'm getting actually more done, I think, in the past year and a half or so than I have previously.
That's interesting. So you're traveling much less. Do you think you're going to keep these habits after as well?
Well, I hope not. I have three kids, and two of them are on the West Coast in Los Angeles and in Portland, Oregon. So I miss seeing them. So I do hope to be flying again.
Yes, for sure. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, well, I think really been in the area of the sociology of mental illness for a very long time now. I started in graduate school as a very naive 22-year-old and was so naive that I didn't even apply for financial aid when I got to Yale University. The head of the program, who I thought looked ancient to me, although he's was then younger than I am now, asked me to come to his office. He says, "Oh, I see you have some interest in studying, you know, mental illness. We have a fellowship we haven't used. Would you be interested in taking it?" And I said, "Sure." So I really studied psychiatric epidemiology there and did my doctoral dissertation looking at how people came to seek psychiatric help. That is, I wasn't so much interested in the actual problems they had as to how they responded to their problems. And I had free access to their files, which is something you would never get today. And I think for very good reason, a number of them were either, you know, children or spouses of my own professors. So that was a little awkward. But the one thing that in retrospect I noticed was that diagnoses were just not an important aspect of the problems, how they were labeled. Many of the files had no diagnoses at all. Sometimes they were sort of an afterthought. That what was it really primary was, yeah, their marital difficulties or difficulties with parents, with jobs, with the emotions they had, but they weren't given a diagnosis. It just was not an important consideration at the time. So then you fast forward about, you know, 10 years, you know, that when the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, was then going to go into its third edition, all of a sudden diagnoses became primary. That, you know, that was the first thing that a psychiatrist or some other mental health professional would do is, well, what diagnosis that does this person have? So I thought this was just exceedingly strange. How could this change go about in such a short period of time when diagnoses were almost non-existent to being at the very center of psychiatric practice? And I've sort of been writing about that ever since.
Oh, this is fascinating. So you were exposed to this treasure trove of data early on, were you?
Yes, that's correct. Data without diagnoses.
So what roles did your mentors and colleagues and also family play along your career journey? And what would be your advice to our younger listeners and early career researchers?
Yeah, well, I had an unusual variety of advisors. Some of them, the person I mentioned was named Sandy Hollingshead. There was another prominent psychiatric epidemiologist at Yale named Jerry Myers. But probably the people I learned the most from weren't in the psychiatric or mental health area at all. They were students of law, criminology, and deviant behavior. So I've really been applying perspectives that I learned in an entirely different area to the study of mental health. So I guess the advice I might give is, you know, not to be narrowly focused on just a particular area, but see if perspectives from other areas can be helpful in illuminating whatever problems it is that you're studying.
Oh, for sure, that's so crucial. So your latest book, The DSM, A History of Psychiatry's Bible. So can you tell us what is it about and how did you come to writing it?
Yeah, well, I really came to write it, as you know, I was saying earlier, in looking at, you know, how the DSM has changed. The first edition arose in 1952. Which was, you know, shortly after the Second World War. And what had happened before the Second World War, the vast majority of psychiatric patients in the United States were in inpatient hospitals. They had either serious psychoses, primarily schizophrenia. Also, many had very serious problems with alcohol, that in the past they had had problems related to syphilis, but by that time, really a remedy for syphilis had been found. But most of them had just such severe problems that they had to be hospitalized in inpatient institutions, and there really were no good treatments for them. What happened was that during the war, there was a vast number of psychiatric casualties, but they arose among people, soldiers who hadn't been mentally ill before. They didn't fit into the kinds of problems, the hallucinations, delusions that marked inpatient populations. There was really no good way to categorize people who became mentally ill as a result of a wartime combat. So the profession of psychiatry really realized that they needed a new diagnostic manual that could encompass a much, much broader range of problems than psychiatrists and other mental health professionals were used to seeing. So that really led to the emergence of the first edition of the DSM, which came to be called DSM-1. At the time, it was just called DSM. And it was really noteworthy in a number of respects. First, it was a very small, little spiral-bound manual. It had about, in total, maybe 20 pages of descriptions of a little over 100 different diagnoses, but these were often just a sentence or two. They were not elaborated in any great detail. And in addition, many, probably even most of them, were heavily influenced by psychoanalytic tenets. That is, they talked about more the meaning of symptoms and the causes of symptoms, but there wasn't very much at all about, well, how do you measure these symptoms? And at the time, that just wasn't very important, that diagnoses really didn't have much of a role to play in the mental health system. And that really lasted through the second edition of the DSM, which came out in 1968, 16 years later, which was in most ways, it had some changes from the first edition, but in most ways was very similar. It was still very short, did not provide elaborate diagnostic descriptions, and largely maintained the psychoanalytic bent of the first manual. So at that time, and now we're into the late 1960s, the social matrix that surrounds psychiatry and the other mental health professions begins to change dramatically. And it changes for a variety of reasons. One has to do with the psychiatry comes under very serious attack in the broader culture. That is, people like Thomas Szasz, who actually himself was a psychiatrist, but he really did not like his discipline, and wrote a very well-known book called The Myth of Mental Illness, where Szasz says that there is no such thing as mental illness. Illness refers to some physical disease. Mental illness is not a physical disease. Therefore, there's no such thing as mental illness. Szasz became very popular in the culture at large. Other people, such as British psychiatrist R.D. Lying, denied that even illnesses such as schizophrenia which in the past had been just taken for granted that people had a mental illness, that those two were, you know, rational ways to encounter the world and not mental diseases. People like Zaz and Lang were very popular in the culture. You had, say, movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which really portrayed psychiatrists as jailers much more than healers. The reputation of psychiatry is just getting to be terrible. So that's one major problem the profession is confronting in the late 1960s and the 1970s. A second problem that arises is really within medical schools. That is that other medical fields, you know, surgery or nephrology, neurology, are really advancing quite dramatically in their ability to define and to develop treatments for the physical illnesses that they are studying. Psychiatry isn't. It has, that psychoanalysis is the major form of the field at the time. It interprets dreams, it talks about transference between patients and their therapists. It really seems to be very, very unscientific. So psychiatry's reputation is really plunging within the medical field as well as in the general culture. So neither one of these things is very good. But it really gets worse. That is, because in the before really the 1970s, third party insurance, that is whether it's from insurance companies as it typically is in the United States or from the government, basically doesn't exist. Patients pay for their treatment out of their own pocket. So no third party insurer requires a diagnosis. But beginning in the 1960s and expanding greatly in the 1970s, the majority of patients begin to have to pay for their therapy through these third-party insurers, and they require some kind of a diagnosis. It became a financial necessity. But that's not all. Another aspect, a totally different aspect, had to do with the drugs that psychiatrists were prescribing their patients. In the 1950s, drugs became very popular, both the so-called minor tranquilizers, which became extraordinarily popular, Librium and Valium. These were prescribed pretty much across the board. It didn't matter what your problems were. If you had feelings of anxiety, which were seen very, very generally, or depression, you took a minor tranquilizer. At the same time, really the first targeted treatments for inpatients became available at all. As well, Thorazine was the most popular drug used to treat schizophrenia. Lithium became a very popular treatment for bipolar disorder. And the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, which regulates these drugs, says to the drug companies, look, you can't just advertise your products for the relief of everyday problems. They have to target some specific disease. So this really forced drug companies and forced psychiatric researchers who looked at drugs to define problems as specific diagnoses. The old way of just looking at very general problems of living was not going to do anymore. So here's another reason. And just the final thing I'll mention that drove the psychiatric profession towards a new diagnostic system is in the United States, the National Institute of Mental Health is the major funder of psychiatric education and research. It was established right after the war in 1948 and had a very socially oriented focus. Its major purpose was to develop community treatments to replace the hospital treatments that had formerly dealt with most mentally ill people, and became heavily involved in politically charged kinds of things to fight poverty, to fight racism. And these became very controversial when there was a Republican administrations. They didn't like the NIMH's social focus at all. So the NIMH realizes, well, they're going to have to move away from this very broad social focus and develop a system of that looks at specific diseases so that they can say psychiatry is a field that's really no different than other branches of medicine. We're going to become a real, genuine medical specialty. So all of these factors really force psychiatry to develop a much more diagnostically oriented system.
So DSM truly served several important needs, just as you described. So who were figures behind it? So who were the people who started it and perhaps later players that contributed to its development?
Yeah, well, in the case of the DSM, and now we're talking about the third edition, DSM-3, there's one overwhelmingly important figure. His name is Robert Spitzer. Spitzer was very interesting person. He became really interested in psychiatry at a very young age. When he was a teenager, he was enthralled with Wilhelm Reich. Don't know if that's a familiar figure to your audience or not. Reich was started out as a fairly respectable psychiatrist and then developed just really far out theories about how sexual problems were at the root of all psychiatric problems. And they could be fixed by if people entered what Reich called an orgone box. And these orgone boxes supposedly would cure the sexual problem. So Spitzer was very enamored with that. He entered psychiatry. At first, he was a psychoanalyst, but that just didn't suit his temperament. He became one of the original research-oriented psychiatrists and really scorned his earlier beliefs in Reich's therapies and psychoanalysis, and becomes determined to really put psychiatry on the same playing field as other medical specialties. So at the time, psychiatric researchers, there weren't a lot of them, but they were growing in power. And now we're talking about the 1970s. Spitzer gets himself nominated by the American Psychiatric Association, their board of directors. They appoint him to head up the DSM-3. And at the time, I mean, nobody took any note of this because nobody cared about the diagnostic manual. Spitzer was pretty much able to do whatever he wanted because no one else was concerned with diagnosis. So he appointed his buddies. There weren't many research-oriented departments of psychiatry at that time. They were largely centered at Columbia University in New York, which is where Spitzer was, and Washington University in St. Louis, which had a number of research-oriented psychiatrists. So Spitzer pretty much exclusively filled the task force that was charged to develop the DSM-3 with all of his fellow researchers, and really excluded the psychoanalysts who had really weren't interested in diagnoses. And although they were far more numerous, especially in clinical practice. And so what you have in psychiatry at the time is a real divide between the clinicians, most of whom are psychoanalysts, who I'd like to interpret the meaning of symptoms. They're dealing with individual patients. They're not very interested in research. They're not very interested in diagnoses. And you have a much smaller group of researchers who, I mean, that's their major interest, is to develop general diagnoses. They are scornful of psychoanalysis. They really don't think much of it at all, but they're the ones who are almost exclusively developing the new manual of the DSM-3. So it's not until the manual is getting finished, but it really begins, the task force for DSM-3 begins around 1974. Around 1978 or so, the analysts and the clinicians sort of realize, hey, we just haven't been involved in this. This might be a major change that's going to affect us. And serious political infighting begins at that time. But it's really not a level playing field, because the entire DSM task force is basically researchers. And when the manual finally comes out in 1980, it's about as far from a psychoanalytically oriented manual as is possible. The DSM-3 completely excludes all references to theory. And since the DSM-1 and 2 were quite heavily psycho analytically oriented, that means psychoanalysis is pretty much excluded from the diagnostic system. And the system itself is totally different. It's completely composed of observable symptoms. For depression, you have a list, say, of you need to have 4 of 10 symptoms. Five of 10 symptoms. If you have 4 of those symptoms, you don't have major depression. So that it's a categorical diagnosis. You have it or you don't. The meaning of symptoms, which most clinicians, that's what they're interested is, how do symptoms, how do they arise? How do they fit into a patient's life? Clinical intuition, clinical interpretation is irrelevant in the DSM-3. So the DSM-3 marks a total change in the way the field of psychiatry is looking at mental illnesses, from very theoretical orientation, very clinical orientation, to a very measurable and specific orientation. And so now, beginning in 1980, you have psychiatry has an entirely new diagnostic system. There's one big, big problem that it is designed to be easily measurable, easily used, and it's expected to allow research psychiatrists to come to understand the causes of the various mental illnesses. And now there's well over 300 of them in the, around 300 of them in the DSM-3, far more than in the DSM-1 and 2. They're expected to lead to better treatments for these illnesses. But the real problem is the DSM-3 diagnoses weren't based on any real body of evidence, because there was only, you know, a small amount of studies that the developers of the DSM-3 could use. And there wasn't, they yielded different results. There wasn't consensus on these diagnoses. You have a manual that's, you know, built to be extremely specific, but yet there's just not very much evidence. It's really built on quicksand. But nevertheless, it's seen as a huge advance for psychiatry. This manual, the DSM-3, is going to make psychiatry a science. It's going to raise its prestige in medical schools. It's going to, you know, allow clinicians, not just researchers, to get reimbursed for treatment from insurers. It gets NIMH out of their political difficulties, because now they're dealing with, you know, a scientific profession and not with socio-political problems. The drug companies love it because now they have a whole range of very specific targets for their products to deal with. And there's a huge spirit of optimism in not just psychiatry, but in all of the related mental health fields. And finally, the problems of the mental health professions have been solved. And in just a few years, we will be making all of these amazing discoveries that will probably, although the DSM-3 itself does not assume a biological orientation, but that at the same time all this is happening, you have all these new technologies that for the first time are allowing researchers to view the brain that just tremendous understandings are expected to develop in forthcoming years. So that was sort of the vibes around the DSM-3.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
It's truly fascinating how this volume has been evolving during all this time in response to scientific research, but also societal factors, hasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I think the major thesis of my book is that it's really the societal factors that are probably the most important in shaping the manual. And they become even more important. The DSM-3 goes into several further revisions. You have the DSM-3R. R stands for revised. That comes out in 1986. You have the DSM-4, which comes out in 1994. These, did have, within the DSM-3 paradigm, you had some significant changes, but for the most part, did not alter the major assumptions of the mental health field. Then towards the end of the 1990s, its researchers are beginning to become really uneasy with the entire diagnostic classification, because they're not finding any genes, either groups of genes or specific genes that just none have been uncovered for any of the DSMs. Conditions that it's becoming apparent that the nature of mental illnesses, you know, are not as nearly as specific as the DSM-3 assumptions would have it, that there's just no progress in the field. And here's where what I find to be the most fascinating part of the saga of the DSM is that, you know, around the turn, you know, of the 21st century, it's now researchers that are leading the charge to completely overturn the same manual that they were responsible for establishing. And meanwhile, the clinicians who initially had completely opposed the DSM, it was just a completely alien form of thinking for them, but they've gotten used to this manual. They probably don't really believe in the various categories, you know, the different anxiety disorders, the major depressive disorders, you know, bipolar disorders, but this gives them a way to bill for their services. So they, you know, they can put the DSM diagnosis down when they're filling out their insurance forms. It serves administrative purposes just fine for them. And they don't, you know, they don't have to think that these, you know, truly represent the problems that their patients have, because they can deal with their patients just as they always have, you know, listening to their problems, trying to uncover the meaning of their symptoms. So that clinicians are quite happy with the existing DSM, which at that time would have been DSM-4. So you have the DSM-5, which really, you know, starts to get underway in the early years of the 21st century. It takes a good while. It doesn't come out until 2013. But the political dynamics are almost exactly the opposite of what they were in the DSM-3. You have the researchers now who are trying to overthrow the diagnostic system that they had originally established, and you have the clinicians who are defending the existing diagnoses. So you have just tremendous battles between the, you know, as you did in the DSM-3, but the sides have reversed themselves. The clinicians are defending the manual and the researchers are trying to overturn it. So the politics here are, at least to me, truly fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds like a proper battleground.
Yes, very much so. And well, ultimately, what happens is the researchers were trying to institute what they called a paradigm change, a completely new diagnostic system, after realizing that they couldn't base this new system on biological findings or genetic findings or neuroscientific findings, because the knowledge just wasn't there. But they decided then to make what's called a dimensional system at the heart of their efforts to overthrow the DSM. That is, dimensions really view mental illnesses not as categories, that is, not as either or, you either have a condition or you don't have a condition. Rather, it's, well, you might have a little bit of the condition, or maybe a medium amount or a serious condition, but it's more of a continuum. You might say it's just like, say, blood pressure, where there's not a sharp division between, you know, high blood pressure and low blood pressure. Rather, it's a gradation. So they start to view mental illnesses in this way, which is totally different from the categorical either or DSM diagnosis. So they try to implement a dimensional system, And here you have a whole new factor coming in, and which is psychologists. And psychologists really were not very heavily involved in previous efforts in the DSM. Just their way of thinking, they're far more quantitative than psychiatrists are. They rarely do their research in clinical settings. They're much more likely to use untreated populations. They use methods such as factor analysis that are extremely rare in psychiatry. But psychiatrists says, maybe we should, invite these psychologists into the revision, of the DSM. And they become really quite prominent, and many of the proposals for the DSM-5 were really almost more psychologically influenced than traditional psychiatric categories of health and disease. But when they finally develop these dimensional proposals, they're extremely complex. They really would require someone, a typical clinician, to have far more statistical knowledge than almost all would have had. That clinicians don't find these dimensional measures easy to use. They really don't have the knowledge to use them. They don't see how they're going to help them understand their patients at all. And they ultimately, what happens is that these dimensional proposals get thoroughly rejected by the American Psychiatric Association, which actually has votes on the DSM. And it turns out, and this is a truly remarkable result, I think, that the DSM-5 turns out to be almost identical to the DSM-4, which was in turn very similar to the DSM-3. So the volume that finally comes out after a decade of sharp political conflicts is very little changed from the previous DSM. So what you have now is a volume, the DSM, that's been deeply discredited. That is, researchers no longer believe in the conditions, the several hundred conditions in the diagnostic manual. The clinicians never really believed in them, but they have to use them just for instrumental purposes. So, but the DSM lives on, and it's completely institutionalized. You see, at least in the United States, where you have, say, direct-to-consumer drug advertising that uses the DSM, social anxiety or major depression or generalized anxiety disorder, now have no credence among psychiatric researchers or clinicians, but nevertheless, it lives on and has become impervious to change for the time being. And so the current state of the diagnostic manual is pretty much unchanged from 1980, even though nobody really believes in it anymore. So I think this is a fascinating situation.
Yes, for sure. So with the reflection to all of this history, in your opinion, what are the implications of having such a manual for the wider society? Do you think it's necessary?
Well, I do think it's necessary because, psychiatry is a branch of medicine. Medicine deals with diseases. It's just so deeply ingrained. in thinking, that this notion of health and disease, I think the notion of dimensions just was never going to play in the society at large. That is, and people now think so much. I mean, it's not just mental health professionals, it's things such as, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, autism, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. These are so thoroughly ingrained in the culture. They all have their own constituency, that the psychiatric diagnoses, which say when you had the anti-psychiatry movement in the 1960s, you know, saw them as, you know, highly negative, stigmatizing sorts of things, that now many diagnoses are highly valued. That is, so that's when in the DSM-5, one of the particular efforts was trying to really change the autistic spectrum. You had parents up in arms because they were afraid that their children were going to lose diagnoses, of which brought about treatment for their kids and other sorts of research resources. You have in other areas, say post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, now is deeply entrenched as almost an expectable reaction to trauma. And that too can take blame away from people. It's not a stigmatized disorder. That the whole value connotations of many psychiatric diagnoses have really been transformed so that they're and highly valued commodities. One of the most interesting examples of this is something called gender dysphoria. That is, when people believe that they're truly of the gender that's not the one that their own sexual organs would seem to indicate they are. That in the past, LGBT organizations have opposed the diagnosis originally of homosexuality, which wasn't removed from the DSM until 1973. But then in the DSM-5 deliberations, that these same LGBT organizations were the most fervent defenders of the gender dysphoria diagnosis. Of course, it wasn't because they thought it's really people with gender dysphoria are mentally ill. They don't believe that, but they have to consider them as such if they're going to have a diagnosis that will pay for gender transition surgery. So it's another just interesting example of how politics plays a huge role and how the value of psychiatric diagnoses have really changed over the course of the DSM era.
So what discoveries about yourself and society along your journey to writing your book, DSM, A History of Psychiatry's Bible, surprised you the most?
I think I would say probably the most surprising thing was I really hadn't been aware of how the psychiatric researchers were the ones responsible for developing the DSM-3. I was not aware of how deeply they came to discredit this manual, to think that there's just almost nothing useful about the current manual, even though they can't now at least publicly say that. It would just put the profession in a completely unsustainable political situation. So they have to sort of kind of defend the manual while at the same time having, you know, totally delegitimized that. And I guess from the point of view of clinicians, how deeply, well, not really ambivalent, how clinicians never really believed in the reality of the DSM diagnoses, but nevertheless, they need them, certainly in the United States more so than in countries that have, say, national health insurance, because they have to put some diagnostic code in order to get paid for their treatments. You know, so just how much the practice, mental health practice and mental health rhetoric differ from each other. It's just such a false front that people are putting forward.
And during your research, how did you prevent yourself from self-diagnosing virtually every condition mentioned in the manual and all of its iterations as well?
Yeah, well, that actually was not a problem because if you think that the whole diagnostic system is pretty much built on quicksand, that you're not going to take it very seriously.
Oh, fair enough. So we've taken up a lot of your time. Can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Yeah, well, I'm currently working on a somewhat similar book to the DSM history, but it's specifically about the personality disorders. So it doesn't have a title yet, but it's about the single class of personality disorders, borderline personality, narcissistic personality, antisocial personality. There's actually 11 specific conditions. Those three are probably the best known. And the personality disorders, I think, are especially interesting because at least you can try and attempt to mold symptom-based conditions, that is things like depression, like anxiety, like PTSD, like schizophrenia, into some sort of legitimate medical conceptions. Personality disorders are problematic for sure. I mean, that they can get people into all sorts of interpersonal and legal problems, but there's just nothing medical about them. So I'm looking at the ways in which these kinds of general ways of living that really refer more to how a person is, their essential characteristics, not what diseases they have, and how psychiatry has formulated them over the years. So that's the current project.
Oh, that sounds super interesting. Hopefully you can come and talk to us about it when it's done.
Well, I would love to. And then you also ask about what's next. And here I just have some very general vague ideas. And these revolve around almost the impossible profession of psychiatry, which not just psychiatry, but mental health professions, where in just one very basic level, they're about intuition, about a clinician looking at a particular patient, trying to interpret their life stories, that they have, they're really much more like a humanistic and intuitive field. But yet in our current, in the 21st century, the only thing that gets respect is science. You have to portray the mental health fields as scientific disciplines, which is just not really what they do. So it would be looking at this basic contradiction between, you know, trying to understand a particular person, which is what clinicians attempt to do, but develop general laws that refer to to everyone, and that don't reside on intuition, that don't depend on any individual's perspective. And it's almost, I think, an impossible contradiction to overcome. But I haven't written a word of that yet.
Excellent. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, certainly one place that that is certainly easy to get is Amazon. We'd have information on several of the books I've written. Most of my books have either been with Oxford University Press, where which would have more information, or Johns Hopkins University Press. The DSM book is with Johns Hopkins. Certainly their website would also have information on on that book. I've also written a book on anxiety and a book on PTSD for Johns Hopkins University Press.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and giving us a glimpse into this exhilarating story.
Oh, well, it was a great pleasure. I hope that we'll be speaking again.